Hi everyone, Camille here. It's 2 p.m. in Sao Paulo, 6 p.m. in London, and 1 a.m. in Manila. We're alive. You're listening to Cosmic, exploring the world of change via the arts, talking to all kinds of artists in season 3 of the show, looking for answers and stories that I am finding out are stuck in the art world, really. Let's open the door and explore together the world of subtle, so we can then transform the hard reality out there, driving change in new ways within society, within ourselves first, making new things possible. That's why we're here, to make magic happen. Are you coming? Good. Get your headphones on, a glass of wine or something, crank up the volume. Forget everything you know. Smile. Let's see where this episode takes us. We're taking off. Today I have something special for you. Again, yes. Last week I talked to Aaron Lee Hill. He's a Canadian visual artist currently based out of London. You heard about him in Cosmic Dynamics yesterday, and you may have seen some of his work already. He uses painting, illustration, stenciling, and sculptural elements within his works, which range from small to enormous murals that explore industrialization, scientific breakthrough, man versus nature, and information saturation. He incorporates found objects and unconventional materials to structure complex multi-layered pieces that are as aesthetics as they are thought-provoking. And lately, Lee Hill has been quite active researching climate change and figuring out ways to create engagement on the topic, which I consider one of the most challenging topics to work with at the narrative level. Taking you to a hostile environment with predators and natural forces at play. Combat, screaming, violence even. Exploring chaos and efficiency as well. At the same time, there might be some fear involved as well. Let's talk about it. Chapter 1, capturing the moment.
Artists are really good at being able to relate sometimes to different information, to different people in different ways. And I think, like you said, it's very left brain sometimes when you have a scientist who has, you know, extreme facts or data that they're relaying to them, and they're making decisions and policy based on that. And I think artists are sometimes really good at interpreting data and interpreting emotions that are elicited through data in different ways that could hopefully and potentially affect change.
Yeah.
you're constantly thinking like, what have I done and where am I going and what is the meaning behind what I'm creating? And I think the theme of man versus nature just kept coming up when I would think about humanity's place in the universe and the current trajectory of our society. There are some quotes that really influenced me in my thinking on that. One was a Faulkner quote, which was, "The aim of the artist is to arrest motion in a way to," I'm paraphrasing now, "but to reflect society back on itself and encapsulate a moment." And so thinking about that idea of the role of an artist in trying to encapsulate a moment in time, that was a theme that just coming up for me. Interpret what's happening and create something that can affect people, as broad as that is. But as soon as you start implanting money into the equation and the economics of it, it completely changes the concept of what is the role of an artist. Reading about the climate crisis, reading about all the different dynamics that humanity is at play in that are unfair, that are devastating for indigenous communities, for anyone not of a certain social and racial class, it creates a lot of anger, frustration, tension inside of you, no matter how cold or no matter how steel-willed you are. And for me, a lot of that, the idea with the work is finding a way to release it back out in a form of energy to hopefully pass that energy on to people and for them to feel that they have more energy to be able to face these problems themselves. There's a certain point in my career where I always liked the idea of art being a Trojan horse, because very early on, I think the aestheticization of art became a critique of art. So for me personally, one of the reasons why I use aesthetics still in my pieces is in this concept of a Trojan horse, that I'm able to access more people that maybe didn't want the opaqueness of a artist statement to be the thing that opened them up to the piece, but that there's still like a visual connection to it. And then through that visual connection, you are able to hopefully embed an idea, a dynamic or a problematic or something into the artwork, into the viewer through that. And so it's a little bit about passing the energy on, and it's a little bit about trying to pass a message on. One thing that I like about my process is that any of these tensions can be released through that initial act that I was talking about, of the gesture. And in a way, it's I'm not thinking about the tension. I'm not thinking about the things that are at play. So it's more of a Zen moment, but it's the release of energy itself that's kind of putting it back into the world that I think is an interesting way to deal with all these contradictions.
This idea of energy transfer through the art piece is extremely important to consider. Aaron's anger, frustration, his tension is turned into something that gives the audience a form of energy. That's the energy plan, the frequency we are interested in here. And it's particularly visible in his work and process.
I will come up with a concept, I'll come up with a dynamic, and usually I will interpret that dynamic through the human figure in motion, which will have within it either a narrative or a dynamic or some sort of thematic that's being expressed. And those initial lines that I'm using, which are these gestural marks, so they're brush strokes, they're paint splashes, and those become almost like the the bones of the piece, or more specifically I'd say like the spirit behind the piece. It's like the initial movement and dynamic that's behind the figurative movement. And so that's where the first initial release comes from. And that one is much more freeing. It's much more Zen, which to me ties in a lot of different ideas within my practice about trying to almost fuse East meets West in a more classical way of those classical ideas of those art forms. The figure to express those dynamics, but those gestural marks are actually, they become something interesting in a mural and also in my paintings. They become the actual grid that I use to get the proportions right. So I take a high-res photo of the image and then I can superimpose on the computer my figure, and after a while it does your head in because you're literally differentiating between thousands of dots on a wall. But you can figure out clusters of pattern. You realize, okay, this arm is in this cluster, and this one dot, which is slightly larger and more oblong, that's where the fingertip goes. Boom, you find that exact point, and you can move from there. So it's an interesting scenario of like something so freeing and gestural becomes something so concrete and mathematical. I fight myself all the time in the idea that like I don't want to be formulaic. So I have that formula and I'll use it to a certain degree. To be honest, that was a formula that was more in play, I'd say, last year and the year before. And now it's moving in different ways.
invite you to go visit Leahil's website while you're listening to the episode, so you can get a sense for his work. It's amazing. His website is on www.leahil-hill.com. I was curious to learn how exactly he got started with climate change. He got to climate change as a focus area, and how big of a risk it was for his career. So here's what he told me.
Thinking about my work is changing a lot the more I research. I have to really credit, there's a really good friend of mine who's also a fantastic curator, Anne-Laure Lemaitre, who's, she's Canadian, French, but was living in New York, and she has become like a really close friend and mentor in many ways to a lot of my work. And she's the one who sort of really pushed me in a concerted effort towards speaking about climate change. For a show, I would do a show. Someone asked me to fly to this place, I would do this thing. And I had my own method of how to be active in this engagement. Like if someone asked me to do a mural, I would ask them for stories. I would, you know, research the place as much as I could. I would, you know, try and embed a story. I would do a photo shoot with local people. But still the impetus to this idea was passive. I just kind of took a bit of a leap of faith and just said, I'm going to stop. And I'm going to put all my effort into doing a show, and I'm going to research and blah, blah, blah. And she really helped me. I wanted to do a show with her, and she really helped me in like narrowing down. And she was like, if you actually look at a lot of your work beforehand, all your dynamics can be encapsulated within the current climate crisis. And I don't think you've ever really concertedly looked at that issue specifically as something that you should engage in. And when she said that, I was like, you're right. You know, everything I've done can be seen through that lens, and this is something that I really care about. So why not try?
Why not try it? I like this because it taps into the obligation to reinvent yourself. It's true for artists, and I believe it's true for everyone. It might also be that the more relevant you are to the world around you, the more likely you are to be considered. Don't you think? Now, let's get a little bit nerdy on climate change, communications, and narrative work. It's one of my favorite topics. One challenge we need to mention here is the financial side of things, which, as you know, in the art world is not always pretty.
That's when it's it gets very tricky to me, especially because there's this concept of art washing, of that you can wash away your own guilt through philanthropic means such as supporting arts. So, you know, I don't know, a painting could speak so much about an issue, and then, you know, someone from Goldman Sachs or from BP oil can buy it, and it's like, yeah, it really moved me to feel something, but is it changing that person's behavior? Is it changing the systems at play in which they're critiquing? I don't know. It's a tough one. I found it really difficult to move beyond just a lot of the doomsday scenarios, move beyond the fatigue and the apathy. And it was, yeah, it was even just hard to continue researching at certain points. And the more that I'm looking into this subject, the more I'm trying to understand how my work can speak about this issue in a way that's not just descriptive. I'd say the only part of doing a descriptive form of artwork that I have been doing that's beneficial is when it's in the public realm, when I'm doing these murals, because I think when you're in an art show, 90% of the time you're in an echo chamber. A lot of the people that are going to these shows, a lot of the people who care about the arts are already in your camp. They already believe that it's a problem, it's an issue.
Prioritizing the public space, that is something to remember. What audience are we actually speaking to, right? And what's the need in practice on the field?
How to speak about this and how to create something that can engage multiple people, can do something a little bit more than just describing the problem. And that's, I'm finding myself at quite a hard crossroad right now, because I'm questioning all the work that I've done and questioning how to move forward beyond that, beyond what I've done.
What's that look upon your face? It seems you've got a lot to say, but no words come. The flow seems to be gone. Let's sing the way through it. How about a new way to pray?
One element that I found out is fundamental to consider in this descriptive approach to the problem is, what part of the problem are we actually describing? Are we describing the consequences, or are we describing the root causes of the problem? And these root causes, are they really the root causes, or are they as well consequences, right? And this deserves a whole chapter later on in the series, and this is a topic we spend our time exploring at Cosmic, as we facilitate relationships between artists and the impact sector. And as Aaron perfectly said,
I think the real issue is trying to find ways in which your work and your process can feel like it's lending something to this idea, to this movement.
Working with an artist on a social or environmental issue is like a superpower, really. One approach is this one, we just talked about it. Capturing a moment, mixing different elements through space and time, conveying energy, emotions, communicating a message which can be ambiguous, opening space for reflection. And yes, that's something a lot of social and environmental campaigns are struggling with, this ambiguous messaging dimension, because you don't control what people are going to think and do. And of course, I'm planning to cover this in depth later on in the series. But for now, let's get into chapter 2, reading the subconscious.
To be more attuned to paying attention to subconscious influences, and a lot of my process would be like I would create something, and then I would step back from it and try and see it with fresh eyes and analyze it in certain ways, like, oh, does this connect to this, and is this meaning that, potentially disassociating it from myself. And I feel like that's when I would learn potentially some kind of subconscious influence. I'd say more so now I think maybe a little too much. I try and contextualize things, and I'm maybe not as non-critical reflecting. Non-critical engagement with my work in a way that's trying to look at it from a subconscious point of view. But I'd say when I'm doing those gestural marks is my tapping into the subconscious. I quite often hate my work for a long period of time until I look at it again. And it changes every time I look at it. Yeah, it's a funny thing. Whenever I look at my work, I often am like, nothing still. Everything's moving. Like, what? Can I calm down? And I wonder about my own reasons for things.
Mm-hmm.
love the idea of holding something still that should be moving in this attempt to kind of stare at it more. I think there's something like one of the things that I always liked about looking at my work was this feeling of like that time is so fluid and it's passing all of us by at a quicker and quicker pace. And there's this moment that feels like it shouldn't be still, but it is, and you can hold on to it. I think my original impetus for this comes from wanting to hold on to memories, wanting to hold on to moments that I feel like I've lost. Like when I was 11, my mom passed away, and I think a lot of, like, I had a very deep conversation with a curator that I'm close with, who was just kind of asking me about you know, why I do these things. And I think the longer I dived into it, there's a subconscious part of me that just admitted that, you know, half the reason of wanting to solidify a moment is to be able to hold on the moments that I couldn't have with her. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, there's like me trying to connect to my parents through that.
One thing that struck me about Aaron is his honesty and courage, asking the tough questions about his process, purpose, and the reasons behind it. And his willingness to share this openly, I think, is admirable and inspiring. Thank you very much, Aaron. The art piece does say something about the artist's subconscious. And this is a track we are going to explore later on in the series as well. What the artistic practice means for the individual, for healing, for finding yourself, for unleashing your full potential, and at the same time, shaping new realities out there. But first, chapter 3, The Tree of Life.
I'm a firm believer that all of us are born as an artist, that as a kid, everyone draws, everyone paints, everyone has that proclivity towards creativity. And it's only through growing up and socializing that slowly gets squashed out of your roundhouse of potential careers and potential options. It's a hard one. It's that idea of everyone's special and no one's special. An artist has this title of being special, right? I think everyone's an artist. Whether everyone's a good artist is a different question.
That's a good one. I asked Lee Hill to describe an imaginary world where everyone practices some form of art.
It would do an astronomically large amount of good for our societies. I think there's obviously tons of potential within the realm of arts for healing, for self-reflection. I think there's a massive amount of perception and empathy that's to be gained through practicing forms of art, because you start looking at the world in a much finer and appreciative lens. Like, there's something about like staring at something and trying to draw it and trying to look at it, or trying to think of something, look at something and think of something in a different way, that gives you a new kind of appreciation. Like, someone will look at a tree and just think, there's a tree. But if you're drawing it, you're literally like, oh, this branch is moving in this specific way, and this leaf right here is doing this sort of thing. And it gives you a texture to reality that's a little bit more beyond the codified lexicon of just like, this is the word tree. First of all, it would make people a lot less bored and feel a lot more engaged in their environment around them, and to themselves, really. Because, I mean, it depends what you want to draw. And most people aren't going to look at a tree and want to draw a tree. Like, they want to maybe draw the dynamic that they feel between them and their partner, or, you know, some emotional abuse that they felt at a certain point. There's so much to be gained through that. I think the thing that other artists would probably be terrified of that idea, because then, you know, how special are they if everyone is an artist, and how do you sell work? But that's being scared of our current mode of economics. The ability that society would gain, from collectively practicing art would be very interesting and extremely extremely productive for our mental and emotional states. Extremely productive for our mental and emotional states. Extremely productive for our mental. Extremely productive for our mental and emotional states.
What a great way to conclude this chapter. I mean, this is a conversation we all need to amplify if the future we want to see is going to come true. That tree is never going to feel the same. Okay, now let's magnify all of our energy before coming back to the world outside of our headphones. Are you ready? Let's go. Okay, in conclusion, once more, we find out how the artist clearly helps us decoding the world around us, or within us, I should say, offering an interpretation of a situation in the language of emotions, and a space for reflection, for contemplation and dialogue. And as a society, we have developed the sad tendency to rely on data, news, economics, and the politics of the future to decide and accept what is possible and what is not. So bringing artists into the mix is clearly transformative. Suddenly, the conversation radically changes. Now your heart and the other half of your brain are involved. And that's probably a good idea when most of our decisions are emotional anyway, right? So still, the reality of change projects looks very different out there. Artists are often brought into projects last minute, when there's no budget left and messaging has been decided already. And that's like, you know, please make a mural around this slogan and please send a sketch by this date. I mean, next week we will unpack the do's and don'ts of artist collaboration with Leon C6, aka the Dot Masters. You may know him, he collaborated with grassroots activists as well as luxury brands, so that's going to be interesting. And we'll talk with no filter, I can tell you that. Thank you to Lee Hill for bringing substance to this investigation, for your time, transparency, and courage answering my questions. You can check Lee Hill's work on his website or Instagram profile. Links are in the notes of the podcast. And there's a man I share 99% of my music taste with, essentially because we grew up together. He's working hard to bring you the soundtracks you all deserve for your cosmic moment. His name is Etienne Previtali. Merci pour le gros son, ma poule. Génial. I'll speak to you soon. You know where to find us. You know what to do. Thanks for tuning in. Cheers.